Okay, we resume our meeting for the final part of today, and we will talk about the post-implementation review of IFRS 10, 11, and 12. And I'll give the floor to Filippo.
Thank you, Hans. Good afternoon, everybody. You can hear me? The due
Not very
process
well.
and
Yeah.
okay.
Okay, go
Better
ahead.
now?
Yeah.
Okay. The due process handbook requires the board to conduct a post-implementation review of each new IFRS standard. The PIR starts with an outreach phase to identify topics that the board may wish to research further. The staff completed this outreach in Q1, and the objective of today's session is to present the findings and to ask the board to approve the next steps. In particular, we will ask the board to approve the publication of a consultation in the form of a request for information and confirm the areas in the standard that should be included in the RFI. We have three papers for the session. Paper 7A presents the findings from the outreach that have been grouped by standard and by requirement within each standard. Paper 7B and 7C present respectively general information on the PIR process and more detail about the outreach conducted, including the main findings from the academic literature review. We do not plan to discuss papers 7B and 7C unless the board members have questions. If the board approves the staff recommendations, at a future meeting we will bring a paper to confirm that the board is satisfied that it has complied with applicable due process requirements. Now, before we start presenting the findings for each standard, I will make a general point in relation to IFRS 10. Stakeholders have expressed support for the principles in IFRS 10 for the assessment of control, and they've agreed that they work well in many circumstances. However, they've expressed the views that applying the requirements in some circumstances requires significant judgment and may be challenging. The staff notes that IFRS 10 requires an holistic assessment of control, which avoids bright lines, and therefore we think the use of judgment is unavoidable. For this reason, the staff think it would be important in the RFI to ask stakeholders to explain clearly in which circumstances making the assessments required is challenging and why. I will now turn to the team to present the findings. I'd like to remind board members that we are not asking you to develop a preliminary position on the areas and requirements mentioned in the paper, but only to confirm which ones should be further investigated in the RFI. And now I will leave it to Jen.
Okay, Jen, please go ahead.
I'm not sure that Zhen's online at the moment. He was having problems with his headphones and microphone.
Okay.
He's just come back in, it looks like.
Zhen, can you hear us?
No.
Can you stand in, Filippo?
Yeah, no problem.
Okay.
So we will move to paper 7A, and in particular, in paragraphs 18 to 42, we present the findings on the first element of control. So in relation to this, we have received a number of comments from stakeholders. And in particular, as I said, the nature of the comments we have received are mostly about the fact that in some circumstances, the application of the assessment of the power over an investee may be difficult. And in particular, people have identified The identification of relevant activities, especially when these relevant activities may change over time, as in areas of complexity. Other areas of complexity concern the assessment of whether rights are substantial, especially when there are conditions present in relation to this assessment, and the assessment of potential voting rights and the continuous assessment of those rights.
Okay.
In paragraph, yep. So I think I will just present all the findings about IFRS 10, and then I will stop for questions. In paragraph 49 to 61, we present the findings on the second element of control, the link between power and controls. Also in this area, participants and stakeholders have expressed the view that in some cases, there are significant judgment involved, and in particular, they've pointed out two elements. The first is the level of variability in returns that is associated with being a principal or an agent. And the second is the identification of de facto agency relationship. In paragraph 62 to 79, we present the findings on the accounting requirements for IFRS 10. And in this area, stakeholders have noted that IFRS 10 does not include a comprehensive guidance for all the changes in ownership interest. By changes in ownership interest, we mean those transactions that result in the change of the status of the investors, for instance, moving from investor. Stakeholders have noted that IFRS 10 does not include a comprehensive guide for all the changes. I'm sorry, I'm getting some kind of echo.
We were getting it back from Zen. I've muted him for the time being.
Okay, so shall I go on?
Jen Zhu seems to be on the meeting platform. That's not where we are, is it? Or are we?
We are.
Okay. Oh, okay, sorry.
He's in the right place.
Okay. Continue, Felipe.
Okay. So I was saying that in relation to the accounting requirements in IFRS 10, stakeholders have noted that IFRS 10 does not include a comprehensive guidance on all the changes in ownership interest. And by that, I mean transactions where the status of the investor is changing, for instance, moving from an investor to an associate to a joint operator or a joint venturer or to control and vice versa. Finally, in paragraph 80 to 90, we present the findings on the consolidation exception for investment entities. And on this area, we have received two kind of comments from stakeholders. The first is that the requirements to qualify as an investment entities are perceived to be not sufficiently rigorous. And according to some stakeholders, there is a possibility for investment entities to have a certain leeway in deciding, in concluding whether they are meeting the definition of an investment entity. And the second comment is in relation of the accounting treatment of investment in subsidiaries that are investment entities. And in particular, stakeholders have noted that because the requirement required the investor parent to carry the investment in the subsidiary that is an investment entity at fair value to profit and loss, there is a loss of information about the investment indirectly held by the intermediate investment entity and assets and liabilities held by these intermediate investment entities, such as financial liabilities for the acquisition of investment. This was a topic that was debated during the development of the exception for investment entities. And finally, the board decided that they would not provide an exception to the consolidation exemption for subsidiaries that are investment entities. I will stop here, and I will ask board members if they have comments or questions on the analysis presented in the paper in relation to findings on IFRS 10.
Okay, I believe I have Mary here who would like to comment.
Yes, please, Hans. I've got some general comments about PIRs, how we approach them, and then some specific comments about the staff recommendation in paragraph 144B1 in terms of what areas we focus on in for IFRS 10, which Filippo has just teed up. And I want to start by saying I think the team has been handed the largest PIR yet, with standards, you know, major standards that have a number of moving and interactive pieces, and we know had some issues in resistance. And so I think all of this is in the context of saying well done to them for wrangling so much information into admittedly dense, but I think very, very clear and coherent paper. And I was reflecting on our experience with the other PIRs and how we have to think about what areas we ask questions about, because I think depending in part on the areas and in part on how we ask the question, we could falsely signal a willingness to reconsider when the board may not be thinking in that way, because really, to me, we should be reconsidering a requirement or reconsidering whether the criteria are sufficient if people, you know, if the preliminary outreach phase one indicates that the, quote, wrong answers are being forced or the tests, let's say, are not operational, that, you know, they just can't be applied or that they are incredibly costly, far beyond what we had experienced. And as I look through some of the comments that are in this first section, there may be a few that kind of fall into that category, but I think we also have to be attuned to when the feedback from phase one is, it's challenging and complex. Well, if it's challenging and complex or maybe judgmental about very complex, individually tailored arrangements, then I think that's suitable. And we should not just let the label of complexity lead us to ask questions when first it might be very tailored. And second, I'm not sure that there's a lot we can or even would want to do. So I think we have to, you know, as the staff goes away to develop the specific areas, and the specific questions for the areas it's identified in 144B1, 1 through 4, I think we have to think about what will we do with the information we get and what signal are we sending. And another area that I think we should be cautious about is scope creep, which seems to be my theme for the day, thinking back to this morning session. Because it's true that people have identified several areas, and, you know, Filippo, you highlighted the change, you know, the lack of a complete accounting model for changes in ownership interest. Now, if the board had an explicit scope decision to not do that before, I guess the question I have about phase one is, has this been shown to be a massive hole in IFRS standards that is a major problem that we should be thinking about fixing? Or is it confirmation of something we decided to exclude? And what is, you know, what's the feedback on that? And does that really feed more into the agenda consultation than it does something that kind of gets prioritized as, ultimately responding to feedback from a PIR? So those, I think, are my general comments, and then just trying to quickly comment on some of the things that you've identified. Power over an investee. I don't think I'd ask generally about power over an investee and do you think we have the right criteria. I think you've identified some sub areas that have been problems, let's say non-enforceable rights, and another is the asset manager's question. Asset manager's question, I think, is a scope question. did we decide before not to provide that guidance? Have we got information that makes us think we have to answer, you know, that question now? And if so, is it as a response to the PIR or not? And with non-enforceable rights, yes, it may be challenging, difficult to assess, but how often does it come up and how often is it a determinative issue? And if it's a, yes, it's really hard in the few instances when it comes up, then I'm not sure that we should be asking questions, because that gets people thinking that we're going to address it, and then we have to deal with unmet expectations. So I think the PIR should either be more selective than the higher level headline that you have in a couple of 1 through 4, and I think if we do ask about them, we should be saying what we think the problem is, why we're looking for that information. It's not about popularity or do you like the outcome, and that, you know, I'll come back to that when we get to I for S 11. So sorry for being a little long-winded, but it's both general that applies across all three of these and some specific things regarding the sub-issues in I for S 10.
Sue?
Thanks, Hans. So, Filippo, focusing on IFRS 10, first of all, and just a few general observations, and I apologise in advance because they're not very specific, so more things I'm worrying about that I'm sort of handing over to you to think about more, if that's all right. Having been involved in one of the events where the phase one was discussed, what really struck me, and it comes through in the paper as well, is a lot of people telling us that there's lots of judgment, and that's sort of the end of what they tell us about. Because for them, the fact there's a lot of judgment is a problem in itself. And I'm not sure what I can do with that observation, because we knew when we issued IFRS 10, and I'm thinking particularly about the de facto control concept that's in IFRS 10, which, let's not forget, took about 20 years plus for standard setters around the world to sort of grapple with, to work out how best to approach it. We knew it wasn't going to be an easy area. We knew it was going to be an area with a lot of judgment. I think somehow we need to try and get confirmation about the usefulness of information, so we've got that sort of perspective, but also to try to encourage people to help us to identify, is there some way we can make the principle of what we're asking them to assess clearer so that they've got a better foundation for judgment? Or do they have specific fact patterns where they struggle that they can help us understand, so we can work with them to work out if there's areas of application guidance or assistance that we can provide that would not take away the need for judgment, but at least give people more confidence that they're thinking about it the right way and to understand the parameters? And I think we need to be specific enough in what we go out with in the PIR that we're encouraging that type of feedback, rather than encouraging a lot of feedback about there's lots of judgment and that's sort of the end of the analysis, because I'm not sure we can help people or they help us much if we do that. And I think that's going to be very challenging with IFRS 10. The other thing I just wanted to talk about on IFRS 10 briefly was the investment entity stuff. Now, I remember back when we were working on IFRS 10, when I was on the staff, we had a whole series of papers that led to these decisions about what happened with subsidiaries that were investment entities and what we did in consolidation. And they were very, very difficult conversations, and they were very complicated conversations, and they were there were some very strongly held views, and we had a difference of opinion between the FASB and the IASB, because we were talking about it jointly at least at one point in time. We had very specific reasons for why we landed where we did. I can't even remember what they were now, even though I worked on the papers at the time. I think we need to, those of us who are involved in the outreach that goes along with the PIR, will need to be really up to speed with what all of the background was there, to make sure we at least understand where we were coming from, what our rationale was, so that we're really well equipped to understand what we're hearing coming back, And I think we also will need to work with investors quite a lot here to understand what the really useful information is, so that we're not sort of defending our position, but rather are open-minded to making sure that we really do, you know, reassess what is the useful information for these investment entities, and did we get it right, and were the reasons for our decision at the time really strong enough to justify this concern that seems to be coming up from an information content perspective.
Françoise?
Thank you. And thank you for the analysis and proposals. I would like to react to some of what Mary and Sue have said and agree with them that we don't want our constituents to believe that because we raise a question, so we, in raising question, we are seeking information, doesn't mean that we necessarily want to be in standard setting mode as the next step, and that we may do nothing, or we may issue educational material, or eventually go to some form of amendment. But if that communication exercise is needed, then let's have it. Let's have it in a request for views. Let's have it reaffirm it wherever it needs to be reaffirmed. But I would not necessarily, though, be restrictive and want to withdraw from what we have in the list on IFS 10 that is that the staff has brought together as part of this outreach effort, because I think that the use of judgment, of course, is well identified as needed in IFS 10. In fact, it was what made IFS 10 so difficult at first to apprehend by people. They had to learn how to have no answer but find the answers by themselves. And I think that I read the paper as in a number of areas, highlighting that the reliance on judgment was such that we could have worries of consistent application. And consistent application is one of our strategic objectives. And whatever information we can gather in order to assess whether we meet that objective, I think is important. So I would, for those reasons, I would not withdraw any of the questions that on IFS 10 that I've seen listed. But if we need to clarify what we're heading to, I would be more willing and encouraging us to do so.
Okay, Jen Chao.
Thank you, Hans. First of all, I appreciate staff's efforts to pull all those issues together, particularly engage with various stakeholders to collect implementation issues arising from, you know, IFRS 10, 11, and 12, and summarize and analyze those issues. Particularly, I appreciate the staff actually did a very good, you know, academic literature review to convince a lot from academic perspective. So I first of all, I think it's a very good paper. Secondly, when I look at those issues, also, you know, echo the comments made by Mary, Sue, and Francois. Actually, those issues have three categories. One is about judgment, yeah, because we introduced the new definition of control. So, and in order to assess control, there are always a lot of judgment involving. But as Sue mentioned, judgment itself is not, should not be a problem. But whether we look back, whether the principle, we can clarify principles, whether we needed to provide further guidance, I think this kind of issue, we can seek further feedback from stakeholders. So second issue, categorical issue, about the gap. It seems that some area, there is a gap between our requirement of the standards and the practice. I appreciated the staff identified area with regard to the changes in ownership interests. We mentioned this area several standards, actually, not only IFRS 10, but we have no comprehensive accounting principle in place. So there are some gray areas. Those areas actually create a lot of practical problems. Some companies even sell or buy part of ownership interest to manage earnings, to improve their, you know, financial position, something like that. I think during this PIR, we need to seek feedback, which area we should fill the gap, and we should improve our standard as well. And the third part of the issue is relevant, actually related to other standards or other projects, such as fair value measurement or fair value disclosure or other things, such as investment entity consolidated inspection. So it's actually relevant to fair value disclosure. If we disclose sufficiently, maybe users will feel happy with that. So based on this, when we drafted the IFI, for example, how to illustrate, explain those issues. For example, we identified four issues with regard to the IS 10. I think first issue and the second issue are all related to applying the definition of control. So I think first we should say that the definition of control, based on our first round investigation, people seem happy with the definition, but there are some, you know, issue come out about the judgment involving to apply the definition, new definition or control. So we can say this is something like judgmental issues, not, you know, particularly we have fundamentally changed the definition of control. And the third issue, as I said, we're trying to fill the gap between existing standards and the practice. So we're not changing the existing accounting requirement, but we'll try to fill the gap. And the fourth, maybe I think relevant, maybe related to other standards, other projects, you know, because that is the exception issue. So it's about how to illustrate the issues when we draft our IFI. But basically, I agree with all the staff's research, all the issues identified. Very helpful for me to come back to look at the standards and how the standards, you know, implemented.
Mary wants to come back.
Yes, a clarification on what I was saying based on Francois's comments. My comment about what's in paragraph 144, paper 7A, is not about eliminating any one of them, but rather, and particularly within in respect to power over an investee, to be more specific about subtopics on that. I mean, the discussion of power over an investee runs through paragraph 48, and there's a long list of issues in there, and I just think we should make it more specific rather than asking about every one, but I was not suggesting deleting power of an investee. A bigger picture thought, and this is radical, so I just want to plant the seed right now. In paper 7C, summarizing the outreach done, the summary starts out in paragraph 6 saying, stakeholders thought IFRS 10 and 12 worked well and improved financial reporting. And I'm wondering if we should, you know, think about how we do PIRs, again, as giving context for the questions we're asking. Say, based on, you know, the first phase, we've heard that these two standards are working well. Therefore, the questions we're asking are more about tuning, potentially, you know, Jingjia was going through a list of whether we should be providing additional guidance to support judgment, whether there are gaps that should be filled or relationships with other standards clarified. But, you know, make the point to people who are responding that these are, in the overall context, incremental improvements, and reminding them that there potentially could be some interplay with other things they may be responding to us about in the agenda consultation and priorities there. It just may be helpful to give a preliminary view. Radical, I know.
Okay, Anne.
Thanks, Hans. I wanted to ask about the things that have come to the Interpretations Committee. So my question for staff is, to what extent have we got other issues in that list of things that have come to the Interpretations Committee? So I'm referring to Appendix A in Paper 7B. And I do that at this point while we're talking about IFRS 10, because I want to refer to one of the paragraphs here. So what my question is, we can see from that appendix that there have been several questions raised with the Interpretations Committee, and different responses have been made by the committee. And I just wonder how staff is thinking about whether there are issues within that list that do need attention within the PIR. Let me illustrate what I mean. So if we looked at paragraph 65 of this paper, you talk about an interpretation that let 14 transactions reported, didn't observe diversity, passed another issue off to another project, which of course is the equity accounting, the research project. But as we know, the equity accounting research project is sitting on the research pipeline / research agenda. I'm just wondering the extent staff have thought about the fact that there are still some other issues bubbling around the Interpretations Committee work means that there are things that should be lead to questions in the PIR.
Rika?
Thank you. I think thank you for staff preparing this very good summary of the information, and thank you for doing outreach to the broader group of stakeholders to gather this information raised in the practice. And I think especially in connection with the IFRS 10, RFI, in the case, if the stakeholder have already overcome their difficulty in practice, I truly think we try not to get in that area to add something or to modify something. By doing so, such changes will make the platform of the accounting practice unstable in the future. So we should try to focusing on the filling the gap between the our intention, original intention of the requirement, including the usefulness of the information and a practical application of the standard if those are not really consistent with what we intended. So I think we need to take a very good balance to do dealing with IFRS 10, PIR especially.
Okay, I see no other request for speaking. So I think we can move on.
I just wanted to make some general comment before I move to IFRS. So I perfectly agree with the board members that expressed the view that the way we ask the questions in the RFI will be very important. And I also agree with Rika's comment about the fact that the threshold to consider changes to the standard should be significantly high, because people have been using those standards and we don't want them to go through the full exercise again if we make changes to the standard. So we are already working quite hard on trying to draft the questions and the request for information in the way that Mary was mentioning, so not giving people the opportunity to just provide generic comments, but we want to challenge a little bit stakeholders to provide precise descriptions of fact patterns, of reasons why the application of those assessment is difficult or not. Again, we're going to be certainly involving the board members extensively in this exercise, but definitely this is the direction we have in mind for the request for information. Anne was asking a question about the interaction with the list of interpretation committee issues. I would say that the proximity of the issues that have been raised in the first phase of the outreach and the list of issues interpretation committee is very strong for IFRS 11. Almost all the comments that we've heard about IFRS 11 can be somehow traced back to the list of questions that have been discussed by the interpretation committee since the standard has been issued. I think there is less of a link maybe for IFRS 10, but we certainly have considered different sources for our analysis. It's not only what we've heard from the outreach, but also what we've read in the manuals from the accounting firms, the list of issues from the interpretation committee, and so on.
Okay. Anne, you wanted to come back in?
Yes, thanks, Hans. Filippo, I just want to follow up what you said about you appreciate the importance of how the questions are framed and you would board input. I just want to know how that fits with your statement on page one that you're not going to bring the questions back to the board.
Okay, I don't think that in the past there has been a public discussion of the draft RFI. We certainly intend to involve the board members in the internal review. I'm not aware that the due process required a discussion of the RFI in public, and I'm also a little bit worried about trying to have a drafting session, but that's something definitely, if the board feel that we have a need to bring the draft RFI for public discussion, we certainly can do that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, all right, let's move on.
Okay, so I understand that Jen is still in trouble from what is equipment, so I'll move to the feedback on IFRS 11. We have grouped the feedback on IFRS 11 in three topics. In paragraph 94-97 in paper 7A, we address comments on collaboration arrangements that do not qualify as joint arrangement and therefore fall outside the scope of IFRS 11. Some stakeholders have required the board to develop guidance for the accounting treatment of those collaborative arrangements. And some have pointed out to some guidance in the US GAAP. In paragraph 102 to 104, we address comments on the classification of joint arrangements between joint ventures and joint operation. We have a number of criteria to make this classification in IFRS 11. And comments are being especially directed at the use of other facts and circumstances to classify joint arrangement that involve separate legal vehicles. And we have received comments, especially from preparers, that the application of this part of the guidance may be difficult and may be burdensome. And finally, the third topic on IFRS 11. In paragraph 109 to 124, we address the comments received on accounting requirements for joint operation. And this is an area where people have repeated some of the comments that have led to submissions to the interpretation committee. So it's kind of interesting because I found there was a little bit of conflicting message because on one side we felt that some stakeholders are saying that they would like to be able to use joint operation accounting for more arrangements. And so they would have to have less arrangements classified as joint ventures. But then on the other side, the stakeholders are saying that they have often trouble in applying joint operation accounting. So these were the three areas, and I'll stop here, and I will ask board members if they have comment on the analysis.
Sue.
Thanks, Filippo. Just one comment, which I think sort of ties in with one of your last statements there about the sort of accounting for joint operations. I think I'm not sure how best to deal with this in the PIR, but what it really highlighted to me when we got the question about leases in the context of joint operations, but it's also come up with some of the other questions we've got to the committee about where there's sort of unders and overs between joint operators and things like that. There's not very much at all in IFRS 11 that explains how you do the entries, which is, you know, not necessarily incorrect. But I think one thing it would be good to gauge through the process would be the extent to which it might be helpful to come up with some sort of educational materials or extra guidance that just assists people in understanding exactly how to do these sorts of debits and credits in this area where it can be a little bit sort of counterintuitive or complicated. And I think that's something we should just have a way of sort of monitoring as part of this analysis.
Jen Chow.
First of all, I agree with three areas identified by the staff. I think first, those, you know, collaboration arrangement is the area that our standards is silent on. So I think we should whether we should fill this gap, I think we needed to seek feedback from stakeholders and to include that issue in the IFI. Second one, I think I know that there are a lot of issues come out with regard to the judgment of those facts and circumstances. Particularly, as Philip said, that in practice, some legal joint venture, there are legal entity there, and legally it's a joint venture. But according our standard, they should still make a judgment based on facts and circumstances whether they can qualify as joint venture as set out in our standards, or they should account for as a joint operation. I know there's a lot of conventional issues, a lot of judgment involving, and so I agree with to include this in the IFI. Thirdly, about accounting requirement for joint operations, as Sue mentioned as well, because we identified four specific accounting issues with regard to the joint operation in paragraph 110. And we also said that actually our interpretation committee actually finalized agenda decision on those four issues. So I'm thinking that because we already have agenda decision on those issues, so I'm thinking about how to articulate in the all those issues in the IFI, whether we are going to seek, whether, you know, stakeholder need, as Sue mentioned, need further guidance, implementation guidance based on those agenda decisions, or whether people actually are not very happy with the outcome of agenda decision. And then we needed to, you know, go through the process to find a better solution, something like that. But when I look at some of the agenda decision, it seems that many of them also relevant to the judgment. They needed to make a judgment based on the contractual terms, you know, facts and circumstance. So it's really relevant to how to articulate the third categories of those issues. And we should be carefully, not because agenda decision already there, and this companies has already applied those agenda decisions. So in order to avoid any, you know, unintended consequences, they need to change again of their accounting policy, accounting practice.
Okay, Mary.
Just a couple of comments and maybe challenge, not in terms of the items on the list, because I think it's absolutely appropriate for us to say in phase one that these were the topics that came up the most. But on the collaborative arrangements, this is, for me, the perfect example of scope creep, and be careful about it, because collaborative arrangements don't fall within the scope of the standards. And, you know, we deliberately wrote the scope in a certain way. Now, I understand getting the, you know, people, when we go talk to them, have an opportunity to say, there's this very similar structure that falls just outside the scope, and it's an area for which we do not have guidance in IFRS standards. You should think about doing guidance on these topics. But that, to me, does not mean that it's a consequence of a failure or something that needs to be addressed as a consequence of the PIR of 10, 11, and 12. I think it almost becomes more an input into the agenda consultation regard, you know, so we could use the PIR to get information about the frequency of these transactions, but if many of them are custom, there may be questions about how much we can do standard guidance. And then looking at the paragraphs that Jingjiao was just pointing to about the application of joint operations, I'm going to make a cynical observation about paragraph 112, where the staff has very carefully said some stakeholders do not share the committee's conclusion that significant guidance exists in IFRS standards, and I wonder if the translation of that is wanted an answer different from the one that the interpretation committee thought was required by IFRS standards, and therefore they are saying we would like you to do standard setting so you know we can get to a different answer. So I think if we ask about these, we have to be asking more, is the information not useful to users of financial statements? Because having heard the interpretation committee discussions of those items, I did not hear anybody raising concerns about the usefulness of that information. I did hear concerns raised about this would be a change in practice from what some people were doing. And so I may be just being a bit cynical on that one.
Okay. Changwu?
Thank you, Hans. I generally agree with the recommendation direction. I have just a couple of comments. One is on paragraph 103 and 104. Preparers are saying their guidance on this area of the classification of a joint operation or joint venture, and also specific factors are on other facts and circumstances. I remember Interpreters Committee once discussed this issue in many, many meetings. And I remember if we update, might have a very good educational material on how to apply these other facts and circumstances. So I'd like to suggest you to examine that if we update on this issue. Another thing is paragraph 101, you are not going to suggest a separate specific question on assessing joint control, whether you are going to include that question in the general question of control when you ask feedback about the IFRS 10. But I think we might need a separate question on this joint control as well, because these two concepts are very similar. However, there is some certain difference between control and joint control. So please think about, again, the possibility of adding a separate question on this joint control. Thank you.
Rika.
Thank you. I agree with the staff suggestion about listing up those three questions, but I agree with Mary's point about the collaboration arrangement, which is outside of the scope of the IFRS 11. So it's really important to solicit feedback from the practice, but still we need to consider how we treat this within, maybe probably outside of this PIL. And then also, I think we, at the same as the IFRS 10, we should carefully consider about how to deal with the feedback on question raised about the IFRS 11. Having said that, I think the number of the frequency of the cases that that falling into the consideration based on the other facts and the circumstance is more than I think originally expected. It's my impression. And also the scope of the judgment required this area is much broader and broader than maybe the originally expected. So I think we need to look into very carefully about what the real issue practice is facing in connection with this judgment. Thank you.
Okay. Filippo, I think you wanted to come back to what Mary said.
Yes, I wanted to make a comment about the collaborative arrangement, because we had a couple of discussions on whether to include that in the request for information or not. But then we thought one of the possible outcome of the post-implementation review is also to start a research topic. So it's not necessarily a decision on whether we're going to have a standard setting or not. But there is also the possibility to use the input from the request for information to put a new research topic on the agenda. And this may be the case with a collaborative arrangement. I found interesting when people were raising this point, because personally, I struggle a little bit to understand what are the problems that they face because those arrangements are not in the scope of IFRS 11. Because, for instance, if you have an equity interest and you're not under IFRS 11, I would expect that the investor would be an investment in an associate, and then you would use IAS 28. So I was a little bit surprised to hear comments like, we don't know what to, how, which accounting to apply to those collaborative arrangements. And that's part of the question we want to ask, not only why they think those arrangements are outside the scope, but what are the accounting issues that these people, that people face, and that they have, that they can't find an answer in some other standard that is not IFRS 11.
Okay. Filippo, I think you can proceed with
okay. I'll just make an attempt with Wenyi, who was supposed to present the findings on IFRS 12. Let's see if at least one other team member can speak.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, we received... okay. Yes, sir? Do you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. We received relatively few comments on IFRS 12's requirements. The overall feedback on IFRS 12 is described in the paragraph 127 to 136 of the paper 7A. Some stakeholders call for additional information on the material non-controlling interests, including the proportionate share of profit and cash flow. Some stakeholders said entities may experience difficulty applying the definition of structured entities and identifying unconsolidated structured entities. And Filippo, do you have anything you want to add? Okay. Okay, I think that's the end of the feedback of IFRS 12.
Okay, any comments? I don't. Oh, Sue, did you want to say something?
Please.
Yeah.
Thank you. So this is a little bit unusual. I think it's the first time we've had a PIR on one of the standards, which is
just a disclosure standard. And given that we get a, you know, mainly comments back from preparers and audit firms on the PIRs from my memory, and it's harder to get feedback from investors, I think that it would be good for us to think about doing some more work of our own on this front in terms of doing some an analysis of what has turned up in terms of disclosures from those applying IFRS 12 and whether it really fills our hopes and dreams that we had when we wrote the requirements in IFRS 12. And one of the things that I was commenting on earlier this morning when we were talking about the exchangeability project that we've been doing through the Interpretations Committee is that when we worked on IAS 7 a few years ago, we were focused on some of the requirements in IFRS 12 about information on risks caused by having cash trapped in different parts of a group that it wasn't readily accessible. I think it would be good to go back to some of those areas where in the past we've thought that maybe we had some application challenges to see whether we still have those challenges, whether the disclosures are what we need, and perhaps most importantly, is there something with the words or the enforceability that we can learn about that is something we should focus on as part of the PIR process? And I don't think we'll be able to rely on the external world giving us all that information. I think we'll need to think about doing some of that desktop review ourselves.
Françoise?
Yeah, on IFRS 12, I would have been keen on asking a specific question. At the time, the proportional consolidation was removed. I think there was controversy on some parts, but also among supporters, and I'm thinking of that, among supporters and including users, there was comments made at the time that it was a wise decision to eliminate proportional consolidation, but it was a pity that the information it brought might be lost. And I would have welcomed a specific question as to whether the disclosure requirements in IFRS 12 make up for that loss.
Okay, Nick?
Thanks, Hans. I have a couple of questions for the staff. Question goes back to paper 7B, where in that paper you set out how the hand describes a post-implementation review. And some of that's very specific, you know, contentious issues that were raised during the development of the standard, identifies possible unexpected costs or implementation problems. But the one thing which it isn't very explicit about is the extent to which the information provided to users has or hasn't been useful. And I just really, given that this is an important PIR and that we have a number of other important PIR coming up over the next few years, just a sense of whether staff's take on that, whether it's simply implicit in some of the more general words that are contained in that description. So that's my first question.
Filippo?
I'm sorry, I don't think I heard very well the question because the sound was breaking a little bit. What we plan to do, because we didn't really have a lot of comments on individual requirements. So the idea we have in mind for the question on IFRS 12 is to ask whether the objectives in IFRS 12 are met when entities are applying the requirements. We have heard a few comments from users that they consider that in general terms that the information is helpful. Of course, there is some user that would like even more detailed information on certain items. And we plan to have some outreach to users to discuss this more in general. So I'm not sure if I reply to the question, but sorry, Nick, I was really losing like half of the things you were saying. So I may have missed a little bit.
Sure. I guess broadly what I was just observing is that how the handbook, the due process handbook, describes a PIR isn't very explicit in terms of asking whether the information provided has proved to be useful or not. And I think it might have been helpful if it did, but clearly that's on your agenda. The second question is around some feedback that we've been hearing through the exposure draft on PFS, which is around associates and joint ventures. And clearly we have some proposals there around the presentation of associates and joint ventures. But there's a specific question in terms of should those items be reported on a pre or post-tax basis? Should the tax be presented separately? Now, from your perspective, is that more of an issue for a project on the equity method of accounting rather than for the PIR?
I would say so. I think that we will be very interested in hearing what are the comments on the PFS exposure draft to see. Because, I mean, some people have made a point, for instance, about whether the presentation of the results from associates should have some implication for the measurement of the investment in the associates. Certainly something that will be monitoring, but I would say that the specific thing you are asking, I would say it more in the context of the equity method project.
Okay, thank you.
Chung Wu.
Thank you, Hans. Yeah, this is also, I agree with your general direction, but one suggestion on paragraph 134, the unconsolidated structured entities. In addition to the preparer's experience on this disclosure, if you can, please collect some feedback from investors, whether they are happy with their current disclosure amount, and there are some quality details on this unconsolidated structured entities, please. Thanks.
Then finally, Anne.
Thanks, Hans. I just refer back to Sue's request for more information about how the disclosures are being presented and the extent to which they're responding to the requirements that are there in IFRS 12. And we've also heard from other board members that this is an important PIR and it's ahead of other PIRs, which will also have important disclosure requirements. So in the KPMG IAAER project, research projects in round six, we had a team from Brazil who did extensive work on IFRS 11, but they also looked at the disclosures. So they've got some quite detailed information. So Filippo and the team have got that detailed report. So to Sue's point, you know, once staff work out what else we should be finding out, there may be scope to build on that existing report and also to potentially work with those people some more to get some more information to answer those disclosure questions. So I know the staff can think about that. Thank you.
Okay. All right. I think we're ready to move to the next paper. Jen is still underwater.
No, as I said, we don't plan to discuss 7A, 7B, and 7C. Sorry, okay. So I'll just bring the last comment on 7A, and then we can move to the questions for the board. I'll just make a comment on something that Sue was saying. There was something we wanted to think about, trying to understand the level of the quality of information following the implementation of IFRS 12. Certainly is not that easy. Something that could be helpful is that when we spoke to ESMA last time, they said that they may have, at the time, well, that was before COVID-19, so maybe things have changed, but they were thinking of doing some research on their own on the quality of information under IFRS 12. So this could be helpful. Okay, so the last...
On the questions, yeah?
Yeah, I'll make just a last comment, because during the outreach, we also received some comments in relation to topics that are addressed outside IFRS 10, 11, and 12, and they are presented in paragraph 137 and following. And there are three types of comment. The first is about the measurement of the investment in subsidiaries, associates, and joint ventures in the separate financial statements of the investor. The second is about the presentation of remeasurement of put option on NCI. And the third is about the equity method of accounting. So the staff thinks that in order to address the first comment on the measurement of investment in the separate financial statements, we need a more general discussion on the purpose of the separate financial statements. And we think that would be beyond the scope of this post-implementation review. The second topic on the remeasurement of put option on NCI is currently being addressed by the FIES project. And then this leaves us with the equity method of accounting. And obviously, there is a strong interrelation between IAS 28 and IFRS 11. But the staff think that at this stage, we're really at the very early stage of the equity method project. And so we do not suggest to include questions in this request for information, but to use relevant input from constituents in order to inform future board discussions on the equity method project. And if there is a comment, then move to the questions.
Questions, okay.
So there are two questions for the board. The first question is to confirm that you're okay with proceeding with the publication of a request for information.
Do we agree with that? I think let's vote for that separately. That would be everybody.
No, Martin, I don't see your hand. Okay, 14.
Okay, and the second question is whether you agree to include that RFI include questions on the topics mentioned in paragraph 144, B, little one, little two, I, first, second, and third. I'm sorry, I don't know how you read that in English. Which are the seven topics that we discussed during the presentation.
Do we agree?
Yep, 14.
Okay, so I believe that brings us to the end of today's discussions. And we will meet again tomorrow morning at 9:30, when we're going to start with discussing the disclosure initiative. Thank you very much, and see you tomorrow morning.